what's the difference between clinical death and information death, and why is it important to distinguish the two of those?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that back in the 1980s. I was, you know, I'd gotten married and had a career, and we'd bought a house, and everything was going along swimmingly. And I was thinking, okay, things are wonderful. What's the next big event in life? You know, there are not all that many big events in life. You know, you're born, you get married. Oh yeah, the next, there's this thing called a funeral, you know. And so I was thinking about the next big event in life, and I was saying, huh, you know, in this modern day and age of the 1980s, is there an alternative, you know? Is there's some other option that I could figure out, you know? So I started thinking about it, and you know, if you're in the research game, the first thing you learn is that you got to define your problem, and you got to define it correctly. Because if you mess up on the definition, it's over. If you define the problem wrong, forget it. You'll never solve it. So I spent, I don't know, over six months, just thinking about what it was that I was trying to do. Because I'd gotten sort of the initial concept. My initial thought was, you know, death is bad. That was my initial thought. You know, it's just not a good thing. By the way, there's a lot of controversy about this point. There are a lot of people that, it's fascinating. A lot of people think, you know, death gives meaning to life. Death is, you know, it's wonderful. Shirley MacLaine has said all her friends who have died think it's the greatest thing. So she's looking forward to it, you know. So there's a lot of discussion about, you know, is death good or bad, and what do we do about it? My take on it is death is bad, and I realize this is a controversial position, but I will stick to my guns on this. I think, you know, I would prefer not dying over dying. I think,
yeah, same.
You know, very, very, very simple. But anyway, you know, that I concluded that death is bad. And then the next question that comes along is, what do you mean by death? What is this thing called death? And then I spent a good 6 months thinking about it. And then I came to the conclusion, well, death is the dictionary definition is death is a permanent cessation of vital functions. And permanent means permanent. So, you know, and there are a lot of people who talk about, well, he came back from the dead and so forth. But that's really just sort of the headline grabbing stuff. That's clickbait. Really, death is meant to be a permanent cessation. It's over. And when you reach the point where it's over, then you say they're dead. And if it's not over, they're not dead. I mean, you know, the famous Mark Twain sort of discussion of, you know, the rumors of my demise have been greatly exaggerated, you know, that kind of thing. So if someone greets you on the street and you say, wait a minute, I thought you were dead. And they say, no, as you can see, I'm alive and healthy. It's the case that if someone greets you and says they're alive and healthy, it's evident that they weren't dead, that was a misdiagnosis. So that's sort of the philosophical issue of life and death. So by the same token, if it's possible to restore you to good health, if it's possible in principle to restore you to good health, then you're not dead. And so that brought me to what's been called the information theoretic definition of death. And I published it and said, hey, this looks like it's the definition of death, which is based on a theoretical understanding. And what it says is that if your structures, if the structures in your brain, the neuronal structures that encode your personality and your memories have been so damaged that it is impossible in principle to restore you to good health, then you're dead. But if it's possible in principle to restore you to good health, you're not dead. You have not suffered information theoretic death. And the focus there is, have the structures been so damaged that it's impossible in principle? And of course, this immediately says that, you know, if you can prevent damage to the structures, then you can prevent information theoretic death. Now, this, of course, is in contrast to the typical definitions of death. The typical definition of death is, well, nothing we do is going to work, so we should give up. And if you look at it, the medical profession has a very operational definition of death. And the operational definition is, here is a set of symptoms. Here is a set of symptoms which are resistant to treatment by any procedure that is available to me. And from a doctor's point of view, that's a very reasonable definition. If there's nothing I can do, then I will announce that the patient is dead. And in a military situation, this is known as triage. And if there's nothing you can do, then, hey, you know, pull a sheet over the patient and turn to the next patient. But that's an operational definition. That's not a definition that has any theoretical underpinning. And if you look, the definitions of death that are in use are in fact operational definitions. They don't have a theoretical underpinning. They are based on the observation that the set of symptoms that are observed are resistant to treatment. And as a consequence, you conclude that the understanding of the theoretical basis of death is missing. Now, in most cases, this doesn't matter. I mean, if you've got a patient who is resistant to treatment by everything you've got available, then, okay, there's nothing you have available that you can do. But if you're talking about cryonics, you're talking about cryopreservation, then you cryopreserve them. And now you have the opportunity to use medical technology of 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, 500 years in the future to revive that patient. So in that case, you have to ask yourself, what medical technologies might be available in the future that could revive this patient? So in that case, you're no longer asking the question, what are the current technologies available? You're no longer asking the pragmatic, what are the symptoms that are resistant to treatment with current technology? You're asking the question, what is the fundamental limit of medical technology? And in that case, you have to ask the question, what is the theoretical definition of death? And in fact, I mean, we're beginning to see medicine today beginning to observe this more fundamental definition, because we're seeing advances in medicine constantly cause changes in the definition of death. Because if you operate pragmatically on what are a set of symptoms resistant to treatment, and then you observe that that pragmatic definition keeps changing as the medical technology changes, then you start to say, hey, wait a minute, we keep changing the definition of the set of symptoms that are resistant to treatment, because as we get better and better, we can treat more and more symptoms. And that's what's going on in medicine today. Doctors are saying, hey, wait a minute, we can treat patients today that we couldn't treat 10, 20 years ago. And they're beginning to look at it and say, you know, we're seeing this sliding scale, what are we sliding into? And they're beginning to realize that there's got to be some limit. And so empirically, they're saying, wait a minute, there's got to be a limit here. And so they're beginning to say, isn't there a limit? And so they're approaching this concept of information theoretic death by observing that their definitions, their changing definitions, seem to be approaching a limit. And that's also occurring at the same time. So it's kind of fascinating watching these definitions of death change. But once you accept the idea that to be dead is to be permanently unable to revive a person, then you start to ask fundamental questions like, what will medical technology be able to do 100 years from now? What are the possibilities? What are the capabilities? And then you get a strong interest in, what will nanomedicine be able to do 100 years from now, 200 years from now? What are the limits of medical technology? And then you begin to realize that cryopreservation should work. And it does not look like cryopreservation is causing information theoretic death. And as a consequence, if you wait long enough for the medical nanotechnology to be developed, then at some point it should be able to restore good health, by which I mean it should be able to restore the physical structures that are encoding your memory and personality and restore those physical structures to a fully operational and healthy state. And at that point, you wake up and you say, hey, I'm alive, I'm awake. How did that happen? Good heavens. I get to see the future.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And
that sounds good.
Yeah, sounds better than the alternative we currently have, doesn't it?
It does. Not everyone agrees with that, by the way, but you know, for those of us who think being alive is good, then hey, you know, this looks like a good deal.
Why do people want to die or accept death? Why don't they want to defy death, even if the technology is available?
Well, there you got me. I don't understand. I just don't. People, I think it's habit, but maybe I'm wrong, because we have lived, I mean, for, you know, millions of years, we've lived with the inevitability of dying at some point. So this opportunity is something which is really quite remarkable. And really, it's this generation which is finally being given this option. And changing how we think about things, I mean, changing how we think is difficult. It's a long ingrained habit that of course we're going to die, of course we're going to grow old, of course aging is inevitable, but it's not. It's only inevitable with a given level of technology. As our technology gets better, we're able to extend lifespan. I mean, right now we live much longer and much healthier lives than we did in centuries past. You can just look at the mortality curves from a few centuries ago or 1,000 years ago, and we live longer, healthier lives. It's simply a fact. And looking forward, we see that we're going to be living longer and healthier lives in the future. So the question is, how far can this trend go? And as I pointed out, a 10-year-old child, if you can maintain the health that you have as a 10-year-old child, then you should be able to live thousands of years. Now, that's going to require very advanced medical technology. And I think it will, I'm not certain, but I think it will require a nanomedicine. I think it will require a medical technology that fully uses medical nanotechnology and uses the ability to build medical nanorobots. But I think it's feasible, and I think we're going to get there. And if we can buy a few more decades by whatever means, I think we'll be able to benefit from that. So that's where we are right now. And we're seeing people beginning to understand that, oh yeah, I might benefit. I mean, life extension has gotten more adherence. More people are saying, yeah, I'd like to live longer. I'd like to, you know, exercise and take various medications that could extend my lifespan. I'd like to look after my health. And then some of the people who are doing that are saying, yeah, well, why don't I look into cryonics? And the way of thinking about cryonics is very, very simple. each year you have some risk of mortality. In other words, the Gompertz curve, if you look at it, specifies your annual mortality risk to a first approximation. Everyone likes to think they're going to be better than the Gompertz curve, that their annual risk of mortality is lower than the average. Okay, so your mortality risk is lower than the average, but it's not an order of magnitude lower than the average.
Yeah.
Right? So your mortality risk is going up with age. So this whole idea of, you know, dealing with the risk of mortality, you've got a risk of mortality this year, and it's going to go up next year, and it's going to go up the year after that. And until we actually manage to get all of these medical technologies in place that reduce your annual risk of mortality, what everyone today is facing is an increasing annual risk of mortality. Now, if you want to take care of this year and next year's and the next, I don't know, it looks like the next 5 or 10 years, it looks like the mortality risk is already there. If you want to address that risk, there's one option on the table, and that option is cryonics. Because if you have a heart attack or you have cancer or you have an automobile accident or whatever it is, there's one option on the table, and that option is cryonics. And then the question is, do you want to take advantage of that option or not? And there's a very simple way of thinking about it. Either you sign up for cryonics or you don't, and either it works or it doesn't. So that's a payoff matrix with four outcomes. And there's some probability that it works. Now, you have to think about it for yourself to decide what value you place in the four outcomes. Different people will assign different values to the four outcomes. And to sign up for cryonics, you got to get a life insurance policy. That's the typical way of doing it. So you say, well, the life insurance policy costs money. What's the cost of the life insurance policy? What's the value I place on my life? You know, stuff like that. And then you have to decide, hey, what are the odds this is going to work? Is it 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1,000,000, 1 in 10, 5 in 10? I think the odds are pretty good. My claim is I think cryonics should work, and we can talk about what I mean by should. But I think cryonics should work because I think the current methods of cryopreservation do not cause information theoretic death, or should not cause information theoretic death. What do I mean by should?
What do you mean by should? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Your memories, your personality are in your brain, and they are stored in the structure of your brain. They're stored in the arrangement of your neurons. They're stored in the connections of the neurons. They're stored in the synapses. And if you look at what cryopreservation does, cryopreservation causes injury. People talk about cryopreservation injury. What is it that happens during cryopreservation? And if you look at what people, the neuroscience community has some fairly strong ideas about what long-term memory is, how it's stored, what it is, what are the mechanisms involved. And those strong opinions center around synapses and the structure of synapses. Synapses are fairly complicated. If you look at the molecular level, the synapse is gigantic. It's, you know, on the order of a micron in size. There are thousands of synaptic proteins that are involved in the synapse. Those proteins don't go away if you cryopreserve someone. They're still there. They might not be in exactly functional status if you cryopreserve someone. So as you cool someone, the proteins that are involved in your body and your metabolism don't exactly function perfectly because of the lower temperature, because of the introduction of cryoprotectants, for a variety of reasons. And also today, there's this whole nonsense about people are cryopreserved when they're legally dead. And this causes infinite confusion. Look, let's put it in small words. I want to live. If I go to my local hospital or my local doctor and say, will you cryopreserve me when I'm terminally ill? Their response is, no, we won't. And they go, oh, well, I don't like that. Why won't you? And they say, we're not saying. We don't think it's good. It's not good. Well, why isn't it good? Well, we're not saying and we're not going to talk about it. We don't like it. It's bad. Why is it bad? We don't want to talk about it. Okay, you don't want to talk about it. It's bad and you're not going to do anything. So I can't get cryopreserved if I go to a doctor or if I go to a hospital or if I go to the standard medical profession. They just won't do it. Okay, so I go to Alcor and I say, hey, Alcor, will you cryopreserve me? They say, sure. We got a whole operate. We have a nonprofit that's set up to cryopreserve people. I say, oh, that's cool. How about I schedule it? You know, if I'm terminally ill, can I schedule it? And Alcor say, well, no, because the law says you have to be legally dead to be cryopreserved. I go, oh, well, why do I have to be legally dead? Oh, well, if we cryopreserve you when you're legally alive, then after you're cryopreserved, you're legally dead, and they'll come and arrest us and throw us in jail. I go, oh, well, that doesn't sound good. So Alcor says, we only cryopreserve people after someone else has declared them legally dead. And you can understand why, because Alcor doesn't want to have, you know, the people get thrown in jail. And that's just the way the law works. And then until a doctor says, I will cryopreserve you and it's a medical treatment. Until some hospital walks in and says, we are cryopreserving people and it's a medical treatment. And we're not transitioning people from legally alive to legally dead. I got to go with it. I have to say, yeah, okay, I'll pretend I'm legally dead to save my life. But between you, me, and the fence post, this is nonsense. I want to live. And the only way I can live is by pretending that I'm dead, which is weird. But there it is. Okay, if that's what I got to do to live, then that's what I'll do to live. I will say, sure, I'm dead. Yeah, yeah, if that's what you want me to do to live, I will pretend that I'm dead. Fine. Okay, you win. Why? I will, but I'm not. I have not suffered information theoretic death. And furthermore, by the dictionary definition, if death is a permanent cessation of vital function, and I'm right, and this cryonics thing works, then I'll wake up in the future, and by the dictionary definition, I'm not dead, because there was no permanent cessation of vital function.
Yeah.
And it's even more interesting because when you look at the ethics, there's even ethics statements by the medical profession that say the terminally ill patient should be allowed to pursue any treatment that they wish. Really? And they should be supported. So if I'm terminally ill and I want to be cryopreserved and that's my choice of treatment, I should be supported in that treatment. But I'm not. So we have the current rather curious situation where I have to announce that I'm legally dead and say, yes, yes, I'm legally dead. And then Alcor can cryopreserve me because Alcor is cryopreserving me after I'm legally dead. And then the lawyers will, you know, and the police will not come by and you know, lock everyone up and throw them in jail for murder. And I have a shot at survival because I have not suffered information theoretic death, or I say that I don't think I've suffered information theoretic death. So we have this very curious situation. And it confuses people immensely because, of course, if you suffered legal death, they say, well, but you're dead. You're legally dead. Yeah. Well, that's what we had to do to make this work, because otherwise they'd throw the team in jail. And then Alcor couldn't do its thing. And the doctors are refusing to cryopreserve me because they just won't. Because you go to a doctor and say, will you cryopreserve me if I'm terminally ill? And they say no. So, you know, we have this.
Will that change?
Yeah, at some point. And there are a couple of reasons it might change. One is you just get enough people wanting to be cryopreserved that the hospital administrators say, oh, there's money to be made.
Yes.
Hospital administrators, they're fine. You know, hey, if there's money, that's fine by them. And then they'll tell the doctors, hey, doctors, go ahead and cryopreserve them. And then some hospital somewhere will do it because there are enough patients. But we don't have enough. I mean, we're not economically interesting to a hospital. You got to have a certain number of patients before a hospital is going to go into the business.
Yeah.
And, you know, frankly,
what will it take for that to be the case? Can more people be encouraged to be cryopreserved than want to?
You know, what in fact is happening is Alcor is got surgeons who are medically trained. So I think what's happening is Alcor is just gearing up to have doctors carrying out the procedure. So I think at some point Alcor just says, hey, we'll do it. And we're doctors. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure how the transition is going to take place. It might be that what happens is a hospital says, we will do it under the hospital's auspices, and then, but we are subcontracting to Alcor. I don't know exactly how the transition takes place, but it's going to be an interesting legal dance. So the answer is, I don't know exactly how the transition takes place, but clearly at some point you shift from a model where you're legally dead and you're cryopreserved to, oh, you're not legally dead, or maybe we get a third category. And there are a bunch of reasons why it might be easier to create a third category in law. Because if you're cryopreserved, you're not going to be active for a long time.
Yeah. You
know? So maybe we say, hey, there's living people who are running around and doing stuff. There are dead people who are, you know, they've been cremated. And then there are cryopreserved people. And then we have rights for cryopreserved people that preserve their right to remain cryopreserved, for example.